The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled East Meets West, the Age of Greek Arabic Philosophy and the Jewish Response, is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmas Reb Chaim Yosef Reuven ben Reb Pinchas Olav HaShalom, Mr. Joseph Tuol, of blessed memory. One of the primary issues of the modern age has been the so-called conflict between science and religion. Discoveries in paleontology, geology, archaeology, and psychology have transformed the way modern man views himself and his history, very often at odds with religious tradition. As a result, religious tradition has in many circles been completely discredited, and religion no longer plays the dominant role in society that it once did. The issues that have been raised over the past 150 years, the age of the earth, evolution, nature of man, form a fascinating body of study that goes beyond the scope of this particular lecture series. What is interesting to note, though, from a historical viewpoint, is that a similar crisis existed over 1,000 years ago. The names of those that created the crisis were not Darwin and Freud, but rather Epicurus, Plato, and Aristotle. As we explained in a previous lecture, in the wake of the ascension of the Abbasid dynasty in the middle of the 8th century and the creation of Baghdad as the capital of the Arab world, the knowledge of Greek science and philosophy that had been preserved by the Persians and the Christian church began to be translated into Arabic. Many of the caliphs, beginning with Al-Ma'mun and Al-Mutasim in the 9th century, were actually patrons of Greek science and philosophy and sponsored translations of the classic works. The translations reached their zenith in the mid-9th century under the Caliph Al-Mutawakkil, and the greatest of all the translators, Hunan ibn Ishaq, known to the Europeans as Ioannitius. He was an historian Christian, not a Muslim, and he translated into Arabic from the original Greek many of the works of the Greek physicians, Galen, Hippocrates, Dioscorides, and the Greek philosophers Plato and Aristotle. Eventually, Greek studies became so popular that to be considered an educated Arab meant that one was acquainted with Euclid's mathematical works, Claudius Ptolemy's astronomical work, the Almagest, Aristotle's works on logic, rhetoric, ethics, psychology, natural science, and metaphysics, and Plato's works, the Republic and the Laws. In addition, many Arabs were acquainted with the metaphysical works of the Neoplatonists, such as Plotinus, Porphyry, Proclus, including a Neoplatonic work that was falsely ascribed to Aristotle, the so-called Theology of Aristotle. But on the surface, Greek thought in its purest form was seemingly at odds with Semitic religions based on revelation. Human reason was placed by the Greeks on a pedestal, and what didn't make sense was rejected by them out of hand. Greek philosophical doctrines such as the eternity of the universe and the remoteness, non-concern, and inaccessibility of what they defined as God, the source and first cause of existence, ran counter to Judaism and the religions Judaism spawned, Christianity and Islam. Religious thinkers grappled with these problems and produced a rich literature. As a result, many Arab theologians rejected the worldview of the Greek philosophers and created their own. They were called the Mutakalim. They and the religious philosophy they created, Kalam, will be discussed further on in this lecture. the first of the famous Arab philosophers to create a synthesis between Greek and Islamic thought was the Neoplatonist Yaqub ibn Ishaq al-Kindi. There are many scholars who felt that he was Jewish, in fact, who flourished at the end of the 9th century. He was followed by Abu Nasir al-Farabi, who flourished in the first half of the 10th century, who, unlike al-Kindi, was much more of an Aristotelian philosopher, not a Neoplatonic philosopher. The greatest of the Arab philosophers of the Gaonic era was probably Avicenna, or Ibn Sina, a Persian Muslim who flourished in the beginning of the 11th century. In addition, Avicenna was the greatest physician of his time. The tension between reason and revelation was felt not only by the Arabs, but by Jewry as well. Then great men arose to resolve the problem. In the period of the Gaonim, two names stand out in particular. Rav Yitzchak Yisraeli, who it seems was influenced by the writings of al-Kindi, and Rav Sadia Gaon. In the post-Gaonic period, the greatest name was that of Rav Moshe ben Maimon, Maimonides, who dedicated much time and effort to resolve this conflict. The approach these Gedolim took in resolving the conflict between the science of their day and religion and the controversy that surrounded them has a striking parallel to similar efforts taken in the modern era. The story of the tension between Greek and Jewish thought and its controversial resolution is the subject of tonight's lecture. One of the greatest works of the Gaonic era is the Emunah V'Deos, Faith and Opinions, written by Rav Sadia Gaon in the first half of the 10th century. In his preface, he describes the state of affairs of his own generation. It's on the first page of your handout. My heart is pained about the condition of humanity. My soul is especially aroused regarding our people, the children of Israel, after seeing that many of them today have imperfect faith, and their attitudes and opinions are not clear of impurities, and many of the heretics have become overpowering and boastful about the inferiority of the reasoning of the people who actually have the truth. It is they, the heretics, however, who are in error. I have seen people like these who have sunk in a sea of doubt and are covered in the waters of error. They have no diver to raise them up from their depths, nor do they have a swimmer to take hold of them and lift them up out of the water. Prasadia goes on to say that despite his own limitations, he was granted the power to effectively reach his generation. On page 2, in paragraph B, we quote from Yedia Hapnini, a scholar who lived in Provence, in southern France, in the beginning of the 14th century. In a letter addressed to Shlomo Ben Aderes, the leader of Spanish Jewry at that time, he describes the contribution and impact that Rav Sadia made in resolving the questions of Torah and philosophy. This Yediyah himself was well acquainted with Greek philosophy and held it in the greatest esteem. And it's worthwhile to quote this. The Rajba himself reproduced this letter in a responsa that he wrote. In every generation, Gaonim and scholars in Spain, in Babylon, and the cities of Andalusia, the southern Spain, arose. Due to their expertise in the Arabic language, they were well prepared to absorb on different levels the sweet smell of the Greek wisdom that was translated into their language. Because of this, they began to filter and cleanse the many opinions of the Greeks through the wisdom of their Torah. The greatest contribution of the wisdom of the Greeks was a heightened understanding of the oneness of the Almighty and its distance from physicality, based on the logical proofs taken from their works on philosophy. The most famous of all the early Spanish or Babylonian Gaonim and scholars was the great Gaon, Rabbeinu Sadia of Fayyum. This is of Egypt, who enlightened the eyes of the generation with his precious works. Of his works, there is a commentary to Sefer Yetzirah, which is a metaphysical work, based on Greek science. Also, he composed the work Emunah V'Deis, which we quoted before, his faith and opinions. In it, he mentions the opinions of the Greeks by making note of them and presenting proofs of much consequence, and by interpreting the opinions and the many expressions of the Torah in a way that would be most easily understood from a scientific outlook. The Rambam, in the 11th century and the 12th century, describes Rav Sadia's contribution in these words, on the top of page 3. In the generation of Rav Sadia Gaon, there were people who entertained destructive views. The Torah of Hashem was almost lost had it not been for Rav Sadia, who revealed what had been hidden in the Torah and strengthened that which had become weakened, and made it known through his speeches, writings, and letters. By the way, Rav Sadia not only had to contend with the views of the Greek philosophers, but also with other Jews who attacked tradition. And in paragraph D on page 3, we quote a work Rav Sadia wrote in response to a Jew, who was al-Balchi, who wrote 200 critiques of the Torah, which he defended. To best understand the philosophical problems the Rav Sadia and the Rambam grappled with, it would be best to become acquainted in a small way with the world view of the Greek philosophers. And let me first start with Aristotle. In the words of the Rambam, this is a quote from the beginning of the Mishneh Torah. And again, this is based on the Aristotelian view of nature. This is the bottom of page 3. These four bodies, fire, air, water, and earth, are the essential elements of all that was created below the firmament. And all that exists, man, mammal, bird, reptiles, fish, plant life, metals, precious stone, pearls, all the rocks used for building mountains and clods of earth, all of its basic materials made from a combination of these four elements. It follows then that all the material bodies which are below the firmament, with the exception of these four elements, are a combination of material and form, and their material is made up of a combination of these four elements. However, every one of these four elements is made up of only material and form. Let me just explain this before we go on with the Rambam. The notion of material and form, which is an Aristotelian notion of existence, of the nature of things, is that there is perhaps a common basic material. This is the hyla of the Greeks, the euli, which has four basic forms. The forms are impressed on them from an outside source, as we're going to. And it's very foreign, because this is not the way we look at the world today. But this is the way, at least Aristotle, and the worldview that was accepted well until the 1600s, 1700s. There is a basic material, and that material comes in four distinct forms. Those forms, these basic forms, are in a sense immutable. Those fire will always be fire, water will always be water, air will be air, and earth will be earth. However, as four essential elements, they will combine together to form new substances. Very much the way we understand in the modern view, how how hydrogen and oxygen combine to form water, which is unlike either hydrogen or oxygen. These four elements combine to create all that exists in the physical world. I'm quoting further on top of page 4. Because there are all the elements of all the bodies that are below the firmament, it follows that the material of every single body, from man, animal, bird, fish, plant life, metal, or stone, is made from a combination of fire, air, water, and earth. All four of them mix together and change at the time of mixing, so the substance that is a combination of the elements is unlike any of them in their pristine form. This combination does not contain even one part which is pure fire or pure water or pure earth or pure air. Rather, they have completely changed and become one body. According to the extent of the amount of the element and the mixture, one can see the action of that element and its nature in the body of the combination. Now, there's something which is 90% water will be different than something that's 85% water. All that is combined from these four elements will eventually separate into its component parts. There are those that will separate after a few days, and those that will separate after many years. Again, this is an assumption that they all assume that everything is in constant flux. Even though there are four basic elements, but there's a basic instability in nature. It is impossible for anything that is a combination of the elements to remain unseparated. Even for gold or rubies, it is impossible for them not to return back to their original elements. Part of it returns to fire, part to water, part to air, part to earth. This change is created by the revolutions of the spheres. And again, this is something we're going to speak of next, again, which is something which is, again, which is foreign to our understanding of nature. But everything is constantly being moved. And through its revolution, these four elements become combined and become the other materials that make up man and the life force of animals and plants and stones and metals. This theory of the four elements, made popular by Aristotle, is attributed to the early Greek philosopher Empedocles of the 5th century before the Common Era. It goes without saying that today we have a very different view of reality, with 92 naturally occurring elements and not just four. The Greek-based view of reality went beyond our world. According to the theory accepted by the Rambam, which was popularized by the Arabic astronomers, the universe consisted of 9 spheres. Because besides the sphere of the earth, there are another 9. Again, in the words of the Rambam, and this is on page 4, the bottom, paragraph B. The spheres are what is called in Scripture, this is how at least the Rambam takes what we call his modern science and projected it into Scripture, reread Scripture. Shemayim, Rakia, Zvul, Aravos. There are 9 spheres. The sphere closest to us is the sphere of the moon. In other words, the moon is in this sphere, and he's going to describe what these spheres are. The second, which is above it, are the spheres which contain the sphere which contains the planet Mercury. The third, which is above that, is the sphere that contains the planet Venus. The fourth contains the Sun. The fifth contains the planet Mars. The sixth contains the planet Jupiter. The seventh contains the planet Saturn. The eighth contains all the rest of the visible stars in the heavens. The 9th sphere rotates every day from east to west. This sphere surrounds and encompasses all of the others. And on page 5, the reason that all the stars are visible and give the appearance of being all together in one sphere, even though they are in spheres that are one above the other, because he has a problem here. Assuming, the assumption, because all the planets have their own revolutions. I mean, this was bothering me. And the stars, it seems, by and large, are fixed. And that's why the Greeks assumed, well, the stars, therefore, all together fixed in one major sphere, and the planets that are moving independently are in their own separate spheres. But we don't see them as spheres. We don't see spheres at all. We just see planets or stars.
And the reason the Greeks gave was that the spheres, because the spheres are pure and clear like glass and sapphire. In other words, light, they're transparent. That is why the stars of the eighth sphere are visible underneath the first sphere. Every single one of the eight star-containing spheres is divided into many other spheres. Because the original theory of Aristotle, of the spheres, even though Aristotle himself only, in his work on astronomy, only spoke of eight spheres. There's only the later Arabic astronomers that came, that accepted nine spheres. But he assumed that they're all just these eight or nine spheres. But there came problems because you would normally assume if something is in a sphere, and we understand the velocity of the sphere, we would understand, we could predict the position at any one time. And there was a problem because it just did not follow the spherical theory. So later Greeks, and this culminated in this in Claudius Ptolemy, came up with the idea of these mini spheres within the major spheres. And in a sense that the star, maybe this planet, may be moving in the sphere, but there's another sphere that's also moving it. So there are different directions that are going, one above the other, like the skin of an onion. Some have spheres which rotate from west to east, other have spheres which rotate from east to west, just like the ninth sphere which rotates from east to west. And he adds something which is very important to understand this Greek view, in Aristotle's view. There is no empty space between them, because it's all filled. The number of all of these spheres, the form of their movement, the path of their circuits is called the science of the calculations of the seasons and constellations, which he interprets to be as the this idea of the science of the calculations is mentioned in the Talmud. And he again reads this Greek science into his understanding of the Talmud. Greek scientists composed many works on this subject. That's how he ends off this section. What? No. No. No, the Greeks did not consider this flat. Right, and the world is spherical. At least in the Rambam, really the Arabic, and this is the Arabic is not their own. This really comes before the Greeks. The idea of a flat earth, which was held in Christian Europe, really is not part of this tradition. Today, due to the work of the 17th century astronomer Kepler, we assume that the trajectory of the planets are elliptical, not circular. There are no spheres. The planets are held together and stay in orbit in empty space through gravity and centrifugal force. Also, since Copernicus in the 16th century, the Earth is no longer considered the center of the universe. In other words, our view is very different than the Greek view, of course, Rambam's view. In fact, the idea there's no empty space between them, even after the view of Copernicus and Kepler and Newton was accepted, there was still a view in science that the universe still must be filled with some substance, which they called ether. Because otherwise, how could we know that light travels in waves, and everything that has waves has a medium? In other words, the waves of the sea are through the vibrations of the water. The sound waves are through vibrations of air. They assume, therefore, that light is through the vibration of ether. This was finally disproven, I mean, by the famous the experiments of Michelson and Morley. Michelson was Jewish, by the way, Albert Abraham Michelson. That it seems it was a result of that there really is no ether, and therefore light waves are propagated in a way dissimilar to to any other form of waves. The discovery of Michelson and Morley was the basis for eventually of Einstein's theory of relativity. Because no matter what direction you're going, what speed you're going, light is always the same. But that's for another lecture. Today, we view the planets as being made up of the many elements of our Earth. The Sun consists mainly of hydrogen and helium. The Moon is made up of rock similar to our own. In fact, they were brought back by the astronomers within our lifetime. We've analyzed those rocks. But the view that was popularized by Avicenna, it was purported in the Neoplatonic work attributed to Aristotle, the Theology of Aristotle, was that the luminaries were actual spiritual beings. And the spheres and the planets and stars were made up of a substance unlike the substance of our Earth. In other words, our Earth, again, according to this Greek view, there were four elements. In the Greek view, the heavens were made up of a fifth substance, unlike the four that we have down here. And of course, according to the Rambam, says the spheres were actually beings. And here on page 5, all the stars and spheres are living beings with knowledge and intelligence. They are living and recognize He who spoke, and therefore the world came into existence, and was the Creator. Every one of them, according to their magnitude and level, praise and exalt their designer, just like the angels do. And he goes on to say in the next paragraph, just to say the difference between them, God created below the sphere of the moon. Again, the sphere of the moon is the one closest to us, according to that theory. A substance which is unlike the substance of the spheres. He created four forms for this substance. In other words, there is a substance which is the basis for the spheres and all the astronomical bodies. There's a substance which forms the basis for our Earth, and it comes in four forms. And this is the idea of forms. These four bodies are not living beings who do not know nor recognize. They're rather like dead bodies. Again, this is a view, again, which is very foreign to those who have not been raised, but it's important to know this view to appreciate the world of the Rambam and the world of the Greek philosophers. The idea of angels. Now, in this view, angels are a little different than you would normally have assumed. Here on page 6, the Rambam goes to say that the angels, the visions of the angels with fire, with wings, is not to be taken literally, but rather they all appear to them as a prophetic vision, in the form of a metaphor. For angels do not possess bodies, nor do they have mass like weighty bodies. In other words, angels do not exist as a part of the physical universe. There are no dimensions to them. And the idea of levels, one angel higher than the other, is not in space, but it's really qualitative. Like one person is better than another. One person is higher, is more intelligent than another. So too the idea that one angel is higher than another. Angels do not occupy space. And he goes on to the next paragraph on page 6. The difference in the names of the angel refer to their respective levels. Therefore they are called Chayas HaKodesh, those who are above all the rest, the Arfanim, Arelim, Chashmalim, Seraphim, the burning angels, Malachim, Elohim, B'nai Elohim, Kruvim, and Ishim. All of these 10 names by which the angels are called refer to their 10 levels. The various highest level existence, save that of the level of God, blessed be He, is the ethereal form, which is called Chayos. Therefore, regarding them, it is stated in prophecy, they're right below the holy throne. According to the Greek thought, which Avicenna, in his work, and the Rambam alludes to this, that actually there's a correspondence of the angels, or these intelligences, with the astronomical spheres and bodies. Because the highest sphere, the ninth sphere, is controlled by the Chayos, by the highest angel. And it goes down a level so that the earth, which is the center of all this sphere, is controlled by the lowest level of these angels, which is called Ishim. And it goes down to the bottom of page 6. The tenth level is the level of the ethereal form, which is called Ishim. These are the angels who speak to the prophets and appear to them in the vision of prophecy. And this is the in Greek philosophy, this is called the active intellect. And it's this Ishim, or this active intellect, that controls everything that occurs on earth. And according to their theory of the forms, all the forms exist due to the intercession of this active intellect, the Ishim, this angel. Therefore, they're called Ishim because their level is close to the level of the knowledge and intelligence of humans, Ish. According to this view, if angels have no space, therefore all the stories that we find in the Bible of angels could not be taken literally. And one of the problems, there's a caveat in dealing with the philosophy of any generation, is to what extent does one compromise the traditional belief, as a means of justifying the reality of what's called scientific thought. And as we have two truths, the truth of science and the truth of revelation. And one has, if they are both true, therefore something has to give. In the Rambam sense, the truth of Greek philosophy forced one to say that all of the passages in the Bible, which seem to indicate that angels do occupy space, are not to be taken literally. They are merely visions. The Ramban, in his commentary on Chumash, takes the Rambam to task. But the Rambam maintained that this is really the only way to maintain this dual reality of basic science and revelation. But just as the whole view of the Rambam, that whole metaphysical view of the spheres and the elements, has been totally discredited. One wonders, even if one deals with today's science, to what extent does one have to sacrifice what we call the traditional understanding of the Torah for what is accepted as truth today? Because perhaps today's truth may be revealed as ridiculous as we call the truth of Aristotle. Amongst Muslim thinkers who had the same problem of dealing with reality and revelation, they came up using other Greek philosophers, and using their own theories they developed themselves. They created a whole different view of life, and in a sense, a life which is very similar to our own, remarkably so. Even though the Rambam, which we're going to quote from him, severely criticizes them. But by modern standards, it seems their view is quite modern. This is the view of Kalam. This is the science of the philosophy of the 8th century Arab theologians. And here the Rambam lists, brings out that there are 12 basic propositions which are common to all of the mitukalemim, in other words, those theologians who believed in Kalam. The first proposition on page 7 is all things are composed of atoms. That's something we take for granted. And this, the idea of atoms, of course, is not new just to the Arabs. The theory of atoms was just as we quote Empedocles, who lived in the 5th century, who had the theory of these four elements. In the 5th century, there were two Greek philosophers, Leucippus and his disciple Democritus, who believed that the real world consists of atoms. The atoms, of course, were different than our understanding of atoms. But nonetheless, it was composed of atoms, and proposition two, there is a vacuum. In other words, there's a distance between atoms. In Aristotelian view, everything is filled. There's no vacuum. This view, which is a very, to our view, a very modern view, which was quite revolutionary, in all probability, works well with the Kabbalah, with the tradition of mysticism, is proposition three. Time is composed of time atoms. You know, one of the great Talmudic scholars of the early 20th century was Rav Yosef Rosen, who was known as Rogatchover Goyim. And he wanted to interpret the Rambam's Yad HaChazaka, his halachic work, his legal work, in the philosophical terms of the Mora Nevuchim. And he dealt with the problem of time. Is time a continuum, which was really the Aristotle's view, or does time consist of atoms? How do we view time? Are there pieces of time? There are pieces of atoms, or pieces of material. How does time work? Is it pulsated, so to speak? Let me just give you an interesting corollary to this about reality and time and the idea of a pulsating existence. Basically, existence is pulsated. Things just don't exist. Things basically are on and off. I remember almost 20 years ago, I visited a museum that had had a very interesting image which was created by light. It looked like a light green statue, but it wasn't real. It was really created by lights. So you look at it and it looks like a real, you know, it really looks like a real thing. Except if you put your hand in there, it's just made out of light. The reality of this is not only the reality of perception, but since it's created by electricity, and something that's alternating electricity, it's plugged in, it's really something that even though that I view this as something which is constant, but really my mind, my eye can't discern it, but really what we're dealing with alternating current, it's something that went on and off constantly. Because it's dealing with pulses of electricity. So this reality really existed through time, but really went on and off, except I view this as something which is continuous. The Metukalim viewed life as time is really as pulses of time, like photons of time, like photons of light. They're photons of time. Time has been constantly created, so to speak. You know, when you see, I feel like a new person. You know, look at them. Yeah, it's true. You know, it's like a new person, because you are constantly being created. So nothing really exists in the true form of existence. In other words, because it existed a second ago, doesn't mean it's going to exist now. It's just you're being propelled into existence again. If only the analogy of that statue of light. Another analogy would be writing on a computer screen. You know, is there, you look, it looks like it's writing, but really it's not. It's just being, in other words, the electricity is really just creating the image constantly of this, you know, of this what I view as reality. And in fact, they make the point, which is again, which the Rambam did not like, really didn't like any of these points, but on the top of page 8, he says, the senses mislead and are in many cases inefficient. Their perceptions, therefore, cannot form the bias of any law or yield data for any proof, which is against, really went totally against Aristotelian view of reality. Because if you can't trust your senses, like what can you trust? They also maintained, which is again the bottom of page 7, which is important for the next part here, the idea of the infinite is equally inadmissible. This is this proposition 11, which the Rambam again tells us of the philosophy of Kalam. Whether the infinite is actual, potential, accidental, there is no difference whether infinite is formed by a number of coexisting things or by a series of things of which one part comes into existence when another has ceased to exist, in which case it is called accidental, or it's called accidental infinite. In both cases, the infinite is rejected by the Mutukalim as fallacious. In other words, things have to have, in the physical world, have to have a definite beginning. I mean, it's an assumption. Things cannot have not existed for all infinity. The things in the physical world, at least. If you're part of time, there must be a beginning. This is an assumption that they assume. With that in mind, I'd just like on page 8, to share with you at least this view of the infinity, of the impossibility of true infinity, at least going back in time. It forms the basis of the proof of the existence of God, at least by Rav Sadia and many who came after him. And this is the idea of the world did not always exist. There must have been an otherworldly being that put everything, that caused everything to exist. But the world that I see today did not always exist. Today we know this to be true, not because of philosophy, but simply in terms of dating. And we know, which has had very disturbing consequences in the scientific community, but it seems that the world itself had a definite, the universe had a definite beginning. And we are expanding. And things were not always in a steady state of existence. So things are always in flux. Things had a definite beginning. They did not have, in the 10th century, they did not have the knowledge we have today. And everything was based on deductive proofs. So the Rambam, the Rav Sadia, on page 8, says the fourth proof is based on the nature of time. And what he comes on, you can take a look at it, is that it's a notion which is a little foreign to us. If there's an infinity of time, so at any point I could go and say, well, yeah, but there's a point before that, a point before that, a point before that. So how do we exist? I mean, this is the problem he dealt with, which others will take issue with. But because if there's always a time before this, so, in other words, if I exist today during this time, but why do things happen now? Why didn't it happen 3 trillion years ago? Or 3 trillion to the 3 trillionth power years ago? How do things occur? I mean, at least this was how they viewed it. How could things occur in the present? They viewed, again, this is the Rambam says, that time must have had a start. Things really could not have happened, in other words, forever backwards. I mean, because what does it mean forever backwards? And if you have any point in time, we'll say, yeah, but, you know, and I'll put that to the trillionth power before that, and before that. So how do things ever occur? It's because if there's no starting point, at any point, well, I'll put, if I take from the beginning of history till now, well, I'll take this ruler and then push it back again. And so how does anything ever really start? Again, it's a very difficult concept. But the Rambam, the Rav Saadia assumed this to be so. Even Aristotle, here on paragraph C, says if there is no first, there's no cause at all. Because how could there be, and is the idea really that we cannot conceive of an infinite beginning? I mean, if things exist, how does it exist infinitely? We can't conceive infinity in the past. So how do things exist? And this was an assumption that those of the Kalam and Rav Saadia accepted this from them, that there could never be an infinity of the past. The Rambam took exception to this. Rambam says it's not proof. In theory, there could be. It was very interesting why I was just barely 17 that I had witnessed a debate between two philosophers. One was the head of the Department of Philosophy in Loyola University in Los Angeles. It's a Jesuit institution, and he was an Aristotelian philosopher. This person was an Aristotelian philosopher who based his philosophy on the writings of Thomas Aquinas, who was the father of the modern approach of Catholicism. The other person was a professor of philosophy from Cambridge University in England. And the question of the debate was the proof of God's existence. Can one philosophically prove God's existence? The Catholic theologian assumed, of course, one can, using a variation of this idea of infinity. And his argument was, well, things are either contingent and is dependent on something else, or not dependent on something else. Everything we know has a cause. And why am I here in the room? Because I walked into the room. Everything before has a cause. Why am I here? Because of my parents. And why are they here? Because of their parents. Everything has a cause. Well, that how could there be this idea of, well, when did it start? If everything is dependent on something else, and again, this idea of you cannot conceive infinity, you know, back in time, then, well, when did it start? It must have had a start. And if there had a start, the thing that started it had to be something that is not contingent on something else. It has something which is absolute. And hence, their proof of God. The philosopher from Cambridge University, his name, by the way, is Professor Wisdom. Deny this whole concept. No, there could be an infinity, a regressive infinity. This is very interesting. Again, it's very difficult to talk about things. Infinity, we can speak of mathematics of infinity. It doesn't bother us. But to think about in the real world, I mean, the whole idea of mathematics is only a conceptual. But to think of reality, of infinity of the past, is really something we cannot conceive. And that really is the basis of the notion of the Kalam. Well, if there must have been a beginning, well, there must be something who started the beginning, because this is the proof of God. Again, which is not universally accepted. I'd like to go in the next part of this lecture. But again, it gives you just a sense, a feeling of what the ideas were, at least partially, of the time. What is the place of philosophy in Judaism? And again, it says you can look at the notes yourself. I mean, Rav Saadia begins here on page 9, and this is taken from the preface to Emunah V'Deyos. The Jewish people as a whole distance themselves from this vocation of the study of philosophy to such an extent that they claim that its study leads to denial of the Jewish faith and to heresy. This was not only in the time of the Rambam, which we know says that there were great debates. Already in the 13th century, they burned the Rambam's writings in France. But the question, should Greek philosophy be studied at all? was really something on the minds of people at the time of Rav Sadia. This is already in the period of the Gaonim, in the 10th century. And Rav Sadia responds, our response is that it only occurs to the most unlearned of them. Anyone who is learned and who studies philosophy and studies the Torah will not come to this conclusion. He deals with the idea of that we're going to go to a greater length, that not only is it permissible, but it's something which is could be on the contrary. Our designer has already commanded us to study philosophy together with our trustworthy tradition. And he maintains, Rav Sadia, that philosophy, one should study philosophy, and it promotes understanding of the Torah. What he does say, and we're going to, is that one cannot have one without the other. He says, because philosophy itself will not, logic, you're not assured that through logic you will eventually arrive at the truth. But if you do have religious tradition, which we're going to, at the end we're going to explain, that he maintains that the tradition of the Torah is impeccable, you use philosophy to support it and to give you a greater understanding of that which you know by tradition. In other words, he feels that one cannot arrive at the truth solely through philosophy, but having revelation, one could appreciate that revelation through philosophy. And that is the opinion of Rav Sadia Gaon. And again, he says here, a quote from, this is in the Munna Vidyas in section 3, in chapter 3, if the Torah had not been given to us and we'd be left to our own devices, we would have diverse opinions about the proper course of life. We would not agree to anything. In addition, the Torah was given to us for the sake of the mitzvahs that are beyond human understanding, must be commanded, as I have explained. So he said, we must have Torah, but on the other hand, we need philosophy to appreciate the Torah. This is slightly different than the view on page 10 of Rav Yehuda Halevi, who when asked in the Sefer Kuzari, and he was asked, the Jewish rabbi was asked by the king of the Khazars about his belief. The rabbi replied, I believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who led the children of Israel out of Egypt with signs, miracles, and tests, who fed them in the desert and gave them the land after having them traverse the sea and the Jordan in a miraculous way, who sent Moses with his Torah and subsequently thousands of prophets who warned them to follow his Torah and gave them promises of goodly reward to the observant and threats of terrible punishment to the disobedient. We believe in all of this, that which is written in the Torah, a very large domain. The king, hearing this, basically they believe, I mean, the belief is based, of Jewish belief is based on historical experience, not on philosophy. And he goes on, you could read this on your own, it says, the rabbi and says, and this is a bold print, now ask the philosophers, you will find that they do not agree on one action or on one principle. Again, he speaks about the difficulty of basing one's life on philosophy. But what about both of them together? It was fine that one cannot arrive at the truth through philosophy, but one perhaps can appreciate revelation through philosophy. The view on page 11 of the author of the Chovos HaLevavos, who wrote this at the end of the period of the Gaonim, this work, this is a major ethical and philosophical work, says, I assert, this is a bold type on page 11, so that anyone capable of investigating this and similar philosophical themes by rational methods is bound to do so according to his powers and capacities. He feels that there's a mitzvah to study philosophy. And he quotes various sources. V'yadata Hayom says that Hashem Elohim says, know ye that the Lord, He is God. It is impossible, continues on to write, as in the bold type, it's underlined here. However, that the people should concede our claims to a superior degree of wisdom and understanding, unless there are proofs and reasonable evidence of the truth of our Torah and veracity of our faith. The Torah makes the statement that you should observe the Torah, for this is your wisdom and understanding, the sight of the peoples. And unless you are able to rationalize what you're doing and to explain it to them, how could you have an impact on humanity? And he concludes, it is our duty rationally to investigate every topic on which we can by the exercise of our mental faculties and to attain clarity. And he writes this in this first section, in the Shari Yichud, this is in chapter 3. This view, though, was not universally upheld about the importance of, a bolstering that which is accepted by historical experience through rational methods. When Rav Hai Gaon, again, at the end of the period of the Gaonim, was asked by Rav Shmuel HaNogid, who was the leader of Spanish Jewry, if one is allowed to study these Greek sciences on page 12, he responded, the proper way of correcting the defects of the body and attaining perfection in human behaviors through the study of Mishnah and Talmud, which is the best thing for the people of Israel. The study of Torah is beneficial for oneself and for others like him, will eventually help the unlearned, for he will draw them close to the ways of Torah mitzvahs. He who distances his heart from this study and involves himself with other things removed from himself Torah and the fear of heaven. For he will suffer from this, the study of philosophy, for he totally cast away from him all the words of the Torah. This distancing will cause a person to assume erroneous opinions, who eventually is unconcerned about forsaking prayer. If you see people who are involved in these sciences and they tell you that this is the well-trodden path and through it they have a grasp of the knowledge of their Creator, don't listen to them. You should know that they're really not being truthful. You will only find fear of heaven, fear of sin, alacrity and great care in doing mitzvot, humility, purity, and holiness in those people who are involved in the study of Mishnah and Talmud. And this view really is would probably be indicative of the view of Ashkenazic Jewry during the Middle Ages, those who took exception to the Rambam's approach, the Rav Sadia and the Chovos HaLevavos' approach to Greek philosophy. Greek philosophy was used in aid of understanding, appreciating Torah, was primarily in the proving the existence of God. Here on page 13, in Psalms we find, in chapter 14, the fool has said, this is Omer Novel Beliboy Ein Elokim, the fool has said in his heart there is no God. But it's viewed, says, as an act of foolishness. Maimonides, the Mor Nebuchim, this is in part 2 in chapter 13, says, I quote, this is on paragraph B, but it would be quite useless to mention the opinions of those who do not recognize the existence of God, but believe that the existing state of things is a result of accidental combination and separation of the elements. This is his idea of the combination and separation with the four elements who are always in flux. And the universe has no ruler or governor. Such is the theory of Epicurus and his school and similar philosophers, as stated by Alexander Efford. And for Dissensis, it would be superfluous to repeat their views, since the existence of God has been demonstrated, was their theory is built upon a basis proved to be untenable. In addition, you find it in by the prophet Isaiah, Yeshaya, in chapter 40, in verse 26, says, lift up your eyes on high and behold who has created these things, who brings out their hosts by number, he calls them all by names, by the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power, not one is missing. It's viewed looking at the stars as a proof of the existence of God. Maimonides, in his part 2 in chapter 19, makes note, I guess, according to this philosophical system, the idea of the arrangement of the spheres, according to his view, and the stars is indicative of an intelligence that designed this. Basically, the idea is if you see something which seems to be the product of design, it was designed. If the Rambam would look at just at the heavens according to his theory, how would the Rambam view DNA, for instance, the whole code of life? Is that also just an accident? And again, this proof, and it's important to realize, and really this is really part of the philosophical struggle, so to speak, of understanding what proofs are. We have proofs which are mathematical proofs. These are basically, the whole idea of mathematics, are based on axioms which are not proven, which are taken for granted, which are the basis of this mathematical system. And based on those axioms or postulates, one now goes to say, well, this is true, therefore this must be true, that must be true. But it's an artificial construct, the whole idea of mathematics. In the real world, what we deal with is not really proofs or the idea of making sense. This is not a proof in the mathematical sense. It's a proof in the idea of common sense. For instance, I cannot prove that an airplane will not fall from the heavens right now in front of Mahon. Can't prove. There's no way for me to prove that it can't occur. And if one will argue, one will cite thousands of instances where airplanes have just dropped from the sky. I mean, those in Lockerbie in Scotland will give proof to this. And there was a plane that fell on Middlebelt Road not far from the airport. And there's nothing to prove to us that it won't happen again right now. But even though I can't prove that the airplane will not fall from the sky, yet generally we don't constantly look up to the sky to make sure no airplane is falling out before we rush to our car. Because we assume the probability of its falling is so minuscule that we just don't take it into account for day-to-day living. We live life on probabilities. A different kind of a proof than we strict geometrical or mathematical proof. The decisions we make in business, in marriage, and how to raise children are all proofs of this kind. We make rational decisions, and we call them rational, but they're based on probabilities, not on what we call strict mathematical geometrical proof. I think in a similar sense, when we deal with the logic by means of design, we can't, if we expect a proof on the order of the proof of similar triangles, you know, if they have the same angles, and if one side has a certain proportion to another triangle, therefore all the other two sides have the same proportion, I cannot expect a proof on that of that degree. But I can't expect it when in terms of getting married or beginning a business or going shopping. I have no proofs. But I live life through probabilities. Those are the kinds of probabilities that are offered as unquote proofs. So when they deal with proofs, they're basically dealing with something which makes the most sense. And it's quite improbable to assume otherwise. This idea, this notion of design, is really not just thought of the Rambam or Rav Sadia. There's a medrash to this point here on page 14, a fascinating medrash. A heretic once approached Rabbi Akiva and asked him, "Who created the world?" And Rabbi Akiva answered, "The Holy One, blessed be He." The heretic replied, "Show me a conclusive proof." Rabbi Akiva told him, "Come back to me tomorrow." The next day he came, and Rabbi Akiva asked him, "What are you wearing?" He answered, "A coat." "Who made it?" "A weaver," he replied. "I don't believe you. Show me a conclusive proof." "What do you mean? How should I show you? I know a weaver made it." Rabbi Akiva said to the heretic, "And don't you know the Holy One, blessed He, created the world?" The heretic departed. Rabbi Akiva's disciples asked him, "What was the conclusive proof?" He replied, "My children, just as a house testifies to the existence of the builder, the garment on the existence of the weaver, and the door on the existence of the carpenter, so does the universe testify to the existence of the Holy One, blessed be He who created it. May His name be praised and exalted forever and to all eternity. Amen." This is from the Medrash Temura, which is in the Otzer Midrashim. Basically, it's saying that this is the proof of design. The unlikelihood, if you see someone wearing a coat, and you look at it, and it looks in this as a, it looks like it's a designer, and you look under, you know, in the inside of it, and you said the signature of the designer. You say, well, it just happened by itself. You know how it goes. You know, the atoms coalesced, and I can't disprove it. But then again, that's the nature of the of this kind of a proof. The Chovas HaLevavos expresses it beautifully. And it says in the beginning, is in the middle on page 15, in the middle of the paragraph, for a thing that occurs after three dots in the middle of the paragraph, in the top paragraph, for a thing that occurs without purposeful intention shows no trace of wisdom or power. Do you not realize that if ink were poured out accidentally on a blank sheet of paper, it would be impossible that proper writing should result with legible lines like those written with a pen? If a person brought us a neatly arranged script that could only have been written with a pen and said that ink had been spilled on the paper and these written characters had come of themselves, we'd charge him to his face with lying. For we would feel certain this result could not have happened without a purposeful planning of an intelligent person. If you see a book, you know there's an author. And this was really, this idea of the Chovas HaLevavos was repeated many years later in our century. But the idea of monkeys writing Shakespeare. Because if you give enough monkeys and enough typewriters for enough time, would they, given infinite time, they would, we would produce Hamlet or Macbeth, or, which does seem a little far-fetched. Mathematicians would tell you that if you had an infinite amount of monkeys on an infinite amount of typewriters for an infinite time pounding, you had an infinite amount of gibberish. But you would not have, for any time in the world, you would have an infinity of gibberish, but you would not have Macbeth or Hamlet. And really, this is the notion of then how do you look at DNA? How do you look at this world, our intelligence? Everything points to a purposeful creator. But yet, the argument of the writing and the paper is a is an argument that is an argument of probability. It's really not a geometrical proof. Who says? So maybe it did happen by itself. I can't disprove it. I mean, in theory, you can tell me, yes, it could happen, but by all reckoning, I really would not, I would not assume that to be so. If somehow, if you got a, you heard a you happened to pick up and it flew by, looks like a ticket for the lottery. And you turn on your radio, and as it comes out, this is the winner. You've just won $40 million. Would you say, no. This paper must have been, you know, there was random paper and some garbage spilled on it, and it just came out these numbers. No, this is not. You would go, you'd be, the radio would still be on. You'd rush, as in this is in 16-degree edit, you'd rush to the thing to get it redeemed, to get your $40 million. In life, we assume the things that look for all purposes as being purposeful are purposeful. Really, and that's really the thrust of this proof. Another very interesting issue, which is dealt with by Jewish philosophers, as well as Arabic philosophers, is the idea, does God know the future, and is there free will? And if we assume that God knows everything that will happen, and the Greek assumption for this, I mean, is, if God doesn't know, then it's there's something lacking with God, and therefore God must know. Well, if God must know the future, then he knows what kind of decisions I'm going to make. If he knows what kind of decisions I'm going to make, how could I have free will? And the other part of it is, therefore, and if I don't have free will, then everything has been predetermined, then what difference does it make? You know, I'll be good if it's planned to be good, I'll be bad if it's planned to be bad, and there's no purpose to make any decisions. The Rambam struggles with this, as well as Rav Sadia. And on page 17, he describes five theories concerning divine providence. One is the theory, which is really the theory of Epicurus, which we'll skip, that really there is no God and everything is by accident, and there's no providence because nothing is planned. Aristotle has already proved the absurdity of this theory, and it goes to the second theory, is, well, one part of this is the Aristotle's theory. And Aristotle's is that God only knows of the part of the world which is under his control, which is the spheres. Again, going back to what we described it, God knows the spheres. But below the spheres, there's our world is not controlled, it's totally random, and it's not planned, and God knows nothing about it. And he says, just in the, I'll read this whole thing. While one part of the universe owes its existence to providence and is under the control of a ruler and governor, another part is abandoned, left to chance. This is the view of Aristotle. He holds that God controls the spheres and what they contain. Therefore, the individual beings in the spheres remain permanently in the same form. Because if there would be any change, which would be unpredicted, in other words, then there'd be something lacking in God. All other movements, however, which are made by the individual members of each species are due to accident. They are not, according to Aristotle, the result of rule and management. When a storm or gale blows, it causes undoubtedly some leaves of a tree to drop, breaks off some branches of another tree, tears away a stone from a heap of stones, raises dust over herbs and spoils them, stirs up the sea so that a ship goes down with a hole or part of her contents. Aristotle sees no difference between the falling of a leaf or a stone and death of good and noble people in the ship. Everything is by chance. In other words, really, God doesn't care. This view is closely connected with his theory of the eternity of the universe and with his opinion that everything different from the existing order of things of nature is impossible. This has to do with Aristotle's theories, but again, there are two worlds, the world of the spheres and our world. Our world is all happenstance. Of course, if you view the world like that, it doesn't give you great confidence in your future. The third theory, which is the reverse of the second, is God knows everything. This is the Muslim, as I have it in Volta's Asharia, which maintained that God knows everything. Everything is planned. If a leaf falls, and again I put in the bold type in the bottom of the page, it could not have fallen before, or after that time, or any other place as previously decreed. Everything is decreed, the smallest detail. According to them, though, then man's decisions are also decreed. And if man's decisions are decreed, there's really no free will, which is really a view that the Muslims maintained, and which Rambam in his Yad HaChazaka, you know, in the Mishnah Torah, takes the task, because if there's no free will, there's no purpose of mitzvahs. There's no purpose of... The whole idea of mitzvahs is to transform yourself. But if it's predestined, then there's no transformation. The fourth theory, which is really close to the Jewish theory, which is again... which is a approach, is the theory of the Mutazila. They have the problem, man has free will. And it's worthwhile to read this. Man has free will and is therefore intelligible that the law contains commands and prohibitions with announcements of rewards and punishment. If that makes sense. All acts of God are due to wisdom. No injustice is found in him, and he does not afflict the good. So far, so good. Except there's a problem. He doesn't go into the Mutazila. Says they profess this theory, although they don't believe in man's absolute free will. They again have this problem of free will versus, God's knowledge. They hold also that God takes notice of the falling of the leaf and the destruction of the ant, and his providence extends over all beings. Notice, according to Aristotle, God doesn't even know about this. It's beyond his, the area which he governs. Whereas according to this, no, God knows about it, but man still has free will. But there are difficulties with this. He has a problem which the Rambam directly does not deal with, but why are children born with defects? They've not sinned. Why should they be punished? According to the Kabbalah, according to the mystical tradition, there's the notion of reincarnation, of Gilgal, that what happens to a person in this world is a result of what happened to him in a previous lifetime. The Metuzila did not believe in this. So how is it that a person suffers? They go on to explain that the reason they are suffering is that it is a that they will be rewarded. And this is part of God's plan, but they will be rewarded for their suffering. Rambam has difficulty with this. The problem is, why do animals suffer? And according to the Metuzila, and again, it's all planned, and they will also be rewarded. Rambam again has difficulty in the fact that animals are rewarded for anything. However, as he says, and this is this is the bottom page 18, but the idea that a rational living being should receive a reward has never before been heard in our nation. The sages mentioned the Talmud not notice it. Only some of the later Gaonim were pleased with it when they heard it from the sect of Mutazilites and accepted it. Notice it's not a Jewish notion. However, I do quote, as there's a Tshuvas HaGaonim on the bottom page 18, which does say this idea that animal suffering, animals will be rewarded. And on page 19, there's a quote from Rav Sadia Gaon about the theory that if animals suffer through ritual slaughter, which has been commanded, they will, for the if there is an extra pain in their slaughter, they will be rewarded for it. And he goes on to say about children suffering, because he says, I see the suffering of children endure, and I know that they will be rewarded. Again, this is the notion that one will suffer for no apparent reason, but will be rewarded for the suffering. There's a parallel notion about Yisurim Shel Ava, that how saintly people suffer, but it isn't just merely the suffering; it's really the challenge of how they react to the suffering. But here we have the notion of suffering and be rewarded for it, not dealing suffering because of sin. The Rambam seems to reject this idea and assumes that all suffering is based on sin. He does not tell us, though, how does one understand the idea of children suffering. Perhaps he also believed in the idea of reincarnation, but he felt, as the Ramban says, and he alludes to it, that really it's one of the secrets of the Torah, and he didn't want to reveal this. I don't know. How does God, but if, there's another part of this, if God knows the future, how do we have free will? According to the Rambam, is God does not plan our future. I mean, we do have free will. There is part of which is not planned, and we make the decision, but nonetheless God knows about this. And the resolution, how to understand this, is one can only understand this if one knows God, one will never know God. But God understands things in a way that we do not. The same problem of free will and omniscience, the God's knowing everything, was dealt with by Rav Sadia, who's on page 20, and is alluded to Rav Yehuda Halevi also, and again this about the Mutu Kalim, that divine knowledge, the fact is that God knows about it, does not cause this. It would be like akin, as he said, that if you know past events, your knowledge does not cause the events, but nonetheless you do know about this. But again, it's something which is for how could we understand, again, how could you know the future of someone, how a person is going to decide, and you're going to say that decision wasn't pre-planned, so how could you know about it? The philosophical problem is that if God doesn't know about it, somehow it's a lack of God. This assumption, the idea of the lack of God, was challenged by other Jewish philosophers. The Ravid Harishon, which we've quoted many times in this lecture series, the author of the Sefer HaKabbalah, the, the history work was authored also a philosophical work called Amunah Rama, was the lofty faith. And he maintained that God does not know the future when it comes to things that we have to decide. And it's not a lack of God. And it's the same view that the Ralbag or Levi Ben Gershon also takes, the philosopher in province, also maintained in his Mechamas Hashem, that really, that so God doesn't know. We have free will. So this assumption the Rambam maintained that God must know the outcome of our decision was really challenged, interesting, by others. But Rav Sadia Gaon and the Kuzri, the Mutzakalim, the Rambam all maintained that God does know how we were going to make our future decisions, even though he doesn't interfere with those decisions. I'd like to finally, just the end of this lecture, this is about the idea, again, the use of philosophy, or at least philosophical arguments, in support of the Torah, was used, at least rational arguments, in the idea of the divinity of the Torah itself. Rav Sadia Gaon, this you can look in the lecture, in the notes here, page 21 and page 22, maintain that the proof of Judaism, and others have said this as well, is that it was a historical experience as part of our history, which he feels that the likelihood of being forged is very remote. He was assuming, says we have some, according to the view of the Torah, of at least some 2 million, if not more, people standing on Mount Sinai, hearing the Ten Commandments, have gone through the splitting of the Red Sea. That generation itself is very remote. They would have made up this story. Succeeding generations, if it had not been part of their own tradition, does it really happen? Wouldn't have made up this, to falsify, to make up a story like this, you need too many people involved. He says, you can't falsify your own history. And this is, again, the assumption that he makes. If everyone says this, this is a document that I mean, no one challenges this, one can assume that this really occurred. And as he said before, the idea of tradition is something so that we have to assume, again, these are one of the probabilities we deal with for everyday life. And it's on the bottom of page 21. Unless there was a true tradition, a man would not be able to know that a certain property was owned by his father, and this is an inheritance from his grandfather, nor would a man be able to know that he's the son of his mother, let alone that he's the son of his father. Human affairs would be in a state of perpetual doubt. So much so that people would only hold to be true what they perceive with their own senses, this only at the actual moment of their sense perception. Opinion which akin to the view of those who affect ignorance, the skeptics, which I mentioned in chapter 1. In other words, in order to live life, we have to have a certain sense of belief in others. If our parents tell us that we are their children, in all probability we are their children. And if we are told that this house belongs to our father and that we have a deed and we assume that it's not forged, we make assumptions of veracity and truthfulness in order to live life. There are certain assumptions we make, you know, just like walking out, the plane doesn't fall down, in order to live life. That's that assumption Rav Sadia holds is in terms of the historical tradition of the Jewish people. And again, dealing with that with that experience is interesting. How on page 22, he says, I think the most wondrous experience of all is the miracle of the manna, the mun. For a miracle which continues for some period is more wondrous than one which passes. For no fraudulent device could be suspected when a people of nearly a million souls is fed from nothing for a period of 40 years. It cannot be assumed that the whole people should have agreed to invent this story, for general consent is sufficient as a condition for the trustworthiness of a tradition. So again, this is what Rav Sadia does, is uses his rational argument in support of the Torah. And finally, this is to familiarize again, because this is This is part of the series of the Gaonim. Rav Sadia arguing against the Muslims and the Christians that the Torah is for all generations, and this is on page 23. He says there is furthermore, says the phrase in the middle right before the bull type, the phrase which occurs in the Torah, Moses commanded us to observe the Torah, an inheritance of the congregation of Jacob. Moreover, says our people, the children of Israel, only a people by virtue of the Torah. And since the Creator has declared that our people should exist as long as heaven and earth exist, it necessarily follows that our law should continue to exist as long as heaven and earth are in being. And he quotes the verse in Jeremiah that as long as heaven and earth exist, so too do does the seed of Israel. If the Jewish people will exist as long as the world exists, and the Jews are only a people not because of land or because of any genetic race, we are a people by virtue of the Torah. That's our constitution. And therefore, in saying that the Jewish people last forever, it's in order of saying that the Torah itself will last forever. And finally, it says, I found the last period of prophecy, God exhorted his people that they should keep the Torah of Moses until the day of judgment, which all would be preceded by the advent of Elijah. Eliyahu, he says, Zichur Torah Moshe, remember the Torah of Moses, my servant, which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel with the statutes and judgment. Behold, I will send you Eliyahu the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. And with this, he argues, therefore, says that as a Jew, only logic should dictate one should continue to keep the Torah. The lecture series will continue on 2 weeks from now. We'll go on to the lives of the last Gaonim, Rav Shrira Gaon, says, and Rav Hai Gaon.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.